outline to mark the location of the body. Of course, they recovered the body from many different locations. Grim, but true. I tried to imagine Finn coming to this particular spot. He'd squeeze through this hole in the fence, or another one nearby. Even if Finn hadn't been high on dope when the train hit him, even if he died of natural causes, he still had been down here for some unknown reason. He was a third-generation railroad man. He knew the dangers of the tracks. So why had he climbed through the fence? The cross began to vibrate. It was almost imperceptible, but it was there. I turned to see the DC-bound Acela hurtling toward me. It was 200 yards away, but closing in fast. I hadn't heard it round the bend. Compared to diesel engines, the electric trains were eerily silent. If Finn had been passed out on the tracks, he wouldn't have stood a chance. By the time he felt the vibrating rails and heard the train, it would have been too late. I crouched low and ducked back through the hole in the fence, bracing for the back strain again. Instead, there was a sharp pop in my left knee. My leg buckled out from under me, and I went down hard, landing on my side. The train zipped past with a high-pitched whine. The ground rumbled for 2 seconds, jostling every molecule of my body right down to the silver fillings in my molars. And then all was still again. I rolled onto my back and clutched my knee. In high school, I'd been a standout football player. I didn't have the arm strength to be quarterback or the long fingers to be a wide receiver, but I had the getaway sticks. I could tuck the ball and run. Senior year, I was the leading scorer. Senior year, I'd also banged up my left knee. Since then, it had been known to act up on occasion. I'd always been able to grit my teeth and bear it. This was the first time it had completely given up on me. If you can't trust your own body, what can you trust? I didn't know what I was doing out here, crawling around a crime scene. As head of the executive branch, Barack held the top law enforcement position in the country. I'd been his right-hand man. That didn't amount to a hill of beans when it came to actual police work. It was like asking Santa Claus to make you a toy train. That was a job best suited for his elves. The fat man in the red suit didn't know the first thing about sanding down wooden toys for good little girls and boys. I had no business here. What would Barack say if he saw me out here, rolling around like a turtle on my back? We hadn't talked since his visit 2 nights ago. As far as I was concerned, nothing between us had changed. Yes, he'd kept his word and put the scare into the police department. The lurid details, as they were, hadn't hit the papers. For that, I was grateful. But there was too much still unspoken between us. I wasn't about to send another errant text through the airwaves and see if I'd get a response. I was through being made to be the fool. Eventually, I sat up and stretched out my leg. My black suit was covered with a thin layer of dust. There was a shiny grass stain on my elbow. I could stand on my knee, but I was walking with a limp as I returned to the van. If Grant noticed, he didn't say anything. Chapter 9. Wilmington Station's official name is the Joseph R. Biden Jr. Railroad Station, though nobody uses it. Everyone still calls it Wilmington Station, which just shows they shouldn't name places after people until they're dead. Thing is, it isn't the only place in town bearing my name. The city also renamed a public pool after me, the Joseph R. Biden Jr. Aquatic Center, down at the corner of East 23rd and North Locust. It's a pretty poor neighborhood. I'd worked as a lifeguard at the pool while putting myself through college. The other lifeguards would ask me questions about race relations, because I was the only white guy many of them knew. We learned a lot from one another. One black lifeguard asked if I had a gasoline can he could borrow. He wanted to see his grandmom in North Carolina. "We can't stop at most gas stations down there," he'd said. The pool was where my commitment to civil rights began. I hadn't fully understood what black folks were up against until then. I would have felt better if they'd renamed the pool after Martin Luther King Jr. or a local black politician, but the neighborhood appreciated that I'd never turned my back on them. I'd never turned my back on anyone. It just wasn't something a Biden did. And it wasn't something I could do to Finn. The station was full of commuters. Rush hour was just beginning. I slipped through the crowd with my shades on, unnoticed, headed for the newsstand to grab a bottle of water. Spending the afternoon outdoors in a black wool suit had left me thirstier than a dry road. When it came to Finn's death, Grant said he was just as stumped as me. He had never seen signs that Finn did any drugs. Was it possible to hide addiction that well? Perhaps we were just too close to Finn to see the truth. Dan Capriati had seen all the evidence firsthand and was convinced this was nothing more than an overdose. Could it really be that simple? Maybe the truth was staring me right in the face. Grant had said one interesting thing. He'd turned over the security tapes from the station to the Wilmington PD, but didn't think they would shed any light on the situation. Why's that? I'd asked. We've got four cameras set up here, all of which record direct-to-VHS tapes that are older than some of the sneakers in my closet. The most they'd be able to see is Finn getting on and off that train for work the day before. Those tapes have been taped over so many times, it'd be a miracle if they could even make out any details through the grain. Another victim of government belt-tightening. What else was new? I believe Grant was right about the tapes. Even if there was crystal-clear digital footage of Finn the day before the accident, it wouldn't amount to a hill of beans. Grant knew that Finn was on time for work that day, and that he'd worked a full shift. There was nothing out of the ordinary, at least from his recollection. There were still the next 16-odd hours to account for, which I was able to reconstruct from articles in the paper, what Dan told me, and Grant's story. Finn had gone home, or maybe to visit his wife at Baptist Manor. Grace had been away at school. She had a place near campus with a couple of roommates. There wouldn't be any cell phone records to trace Finn's movements because Finn didn't carry a cell phone. He was one of the last holdouts of our generation, I suspected. Hated the damn things with a passion. I hated them too, but you couldn't deny how much they changed our lives, how much they changed the world. And yet I knew that even if he had been carrying a phone, even if we could trace his movements through the cell towers it pinged, a trick I'd seen on Law and Order more than once, it would only beg more questions. I limped past the shoeshine stand. The elevated chair was empty, but there was a dark-skinned man sitting hunched on a bench, counting cash inside a zippered money bag. A newsboy cap covered his eyes, but this was no newsboy. This was Greg McGovern, a.k.a. the mayor of Wilmington Station. He knew everyone who passed through the station with any regularity. If anything went on in his station, he knew about it. I took a seat in his chair. The pain in my knee momentarily went away. The mayor didn't look up. "Be with you in a moment," he said, his voice crackling like an old record. The mayor was my senior by at least a decade. It had been about that long since I'd seen him, too. The last couple of times there had been a young man shining shoes in his place. I'd sort of figured the mayor had retired. I'd figured wrong. "Take your time," I replied. He froze and slowly met my eyes. His face was webbed with creases. "Amtrak Joe. Didn't expect to see you round here. How's the missus?" "She's good. Still teaching." The mayor zippered his money pouch and hid it in a drawer. He didn't have any family. All he had were the commuters who passed the time with him in this worn-out chair. The cracked leather seat was badly in need of replacing, just as it had been on my first visit in the 70s. Back then the mayor had been a young man, just like me. The years had chewed us up and spit us out like tobacco. He took one of my shoes in his hand. It was covered in dirt from the field. He didn't say anything as he got to work on it. He'd seen much worse in his day. "Just came from Finn's service," I said.
"Uh-huh."
"You following the news?"
"I hear things," he said.
"Good things or bad things?" He shook his head.
"Just things."
"The police say it was an accident. That Finn got high and stumbled onto the tracks."
"High on what? Life?"
"Heroin." The mayor paused, then resumed his work.
"I never seen him take a drink," he said. "We played cards together Saturday nights. Me, him, Alvin, Grant. Knew him as well as you can know anybody, I suppose."
"You hear anything interesting about him?"
"Interesting?"
"Yeah," I said. "I'm trying to figure out what happened, how he ended up out there in the tracks, where the drugs came from." He glanced from side to side without looking up at me, like he was scanning the crowd for somebody to rush in if he gave the wrong answer. He didn't trust me.
"If the police say he was on drugs, then it must be true," he said.
He gave my shoes one last pat with his rag.
"Sure was nice to see you again, Mr. Vice President."
"It's just Mr. Biden now."
"I suppose it is. Anything else, Mr. Biden?"
He still had a smile on his face, but he'd shut down. He had every right in the world not to trust me. If I was coming off too much like a cop, it was because I didn't have the time for pleasantries. I pulled my wallet out, but he waved me off.
"This one's on the house."
My hand hesitated on a 20, but I handed him a business card instead. Jill had designed them for me when we'd started our foundation, but I'd been slow to give them away. Too many strangers already had my number. The mayor fingered the card and glanced up at me. "In case you guys need another card player sometime," I said.
"What do you play?"
"Gin rummy."
"Rummy," he repeated. "You any good?"
I grinned. "It's been so long I can't remember." He nodded. But I could tell from his skeptical expression that he was trying to figure me out. My mind was sharp as a switchblade. I remembered the last time I'd played gin rummy, just as I remembered the first time and every time in between. It was the only card game that had ever held my interest, because it was one of the few where memory and strategy weighed more than the luck of the draw. I wasn't interested in playing cards, though. I was interested in getting to the bottom of this whole business with Finn. So far, I wasn't being quick to point fingers. That is a way of blowing up in your face. But I also wasn't going to dilly-dally. Dan Capriotti had made it clear that the Wilmington PD was content to sit back and wait for the toxicology results. That wasn't good enough for me. I grabbed a water bottle at the newsstand and joined the short line for the register. I didn't recognize the cashier. That happened a lot more nowadays than it used to. People moved around the country more, especially the younger generations. They followed their jobs, their hearts, their intuition. Picking up roots was easier to do than putting them down. Of course, my family had moved from Pennsylvania to Delaware once upon a time. We'd been outsiders. As much as I liked to think of Wilmington as my town, it had been someone else's first. And someone else's before that, all the way back to the first known settlers, the Lenni Lenape Indians. My phone buzzed with a text. It was Jill. She was going to be late. Could I find my own way home and thaw out the chicken? She wondered. "Is that all?" a voice asked. I looked up. "Oh, sorry," I told the girl at the register. "Just the water." As she was ringing it up, the flower bouquets on the counter caught my eye. "And one of those." It was an impulse buy, an $18 impulse buy. I couldn't identify any of the flowers. Heck, they could have been weeds for all I knew, but they were pretty, and I wanted Jill to have them. Outside, I fired up Uber. My ride would be there in 7 minutes. It was rush hour, but it was also Wilmington. Traffic never got as bad as it did in D.C., thank God. I texted Jill, telling her I was on my way home, and the chicken would be thawed in time for dinner at 6. A black Cadillac Escalade pulled up to the curb in front of me. The truck-sized SUV sat there, idling. Was my ride early? If there was an Uber sign on the dash, I had no way of knowing. I couldn't see anything through the heavily tinted windows. Suppose this wasn't my ride. Suppose it was some enemy of the state, some deranged lunatic fixated on a former vice president. Suppose Finn wasn't the one who'd left the printout of my address behind on the train. My heart rate began to ratchet up. I had no Secret Service protection anymore, no private security. I didn't even have my pistol, because who brings a gun to a funeral? The vehicle just sat there, towering over me. There was nothing stopping a passenger from rolling down one of the windows and poking me full of holes. I was a sitting duck, with no wings to carry me away. I inhaled sharply and squeezed the bouquet tight. Water dripped out the bottom and onto the cement. The tinted back window lowered.
"Need a lift?"
Barack Obama asked. Chapter 10. I buckled myself into the seat across the aisle from Barack. There was one more row of seats behind us, all empty. The same talkative agent who'd been with Barack a few nights ago in my backyard was in the driver's seat fiddling with the air conditioning. Barack's ever-present gaggle of aides and personal assistants were, once again, MIA. Couldn't say I missed them. "I thought the funeral was earlier this afternoon," Barack said, eyeing the flowers. "These are for Jill. I'm on my way home. Those are lilies, Joe."
"So?"
"So it's a sympathy arrangement. The lily is a funeral flower. If you were going to be romantic, you should have gone for roses." The Escalade eased into traffic. I stared at the flowers in my hand. They looked like regular white flowers. They had some red roses, but they were 3 times the price. Barack made a little finger gun and pointed it at me. "That's why they're more romantic." I sighed. Barack was right. He was always right. "Anyway, I was headed home, and..." He patted me on my knee, the good one. "What dropped you off?" he said.
I leaned forward between the seats and pointed to the approaching on-ramp. You're better off avoiding the interstate this time of day if you can. Stay on this road for another mile until you hit the four-way stop. Turn left and stay on 30 East until you see the sign for the Christmas tree farm. Stinson's. It's closed during the summer, but if you ever need a Christmas tree, they grow them big and tall. Unless you're Jewish. Are you Jewish? No, sir, Steve said. You ever had matzo ball soup? He already has your address, Joe, Barack said, cutting in. How do you think we got to your place earlier this week? I patted Steve on the shoulder, and he flinched slightly. Service agents were known to be a little jumpy. Let me know if you need anything, partner. I leaned back in the seat. Barack stared at me for a beat.
You look like you've been playing football, he said.
My shoes were shined, but the rest of my suit was filthy. I tripped. It's nothing, really. Barack said. The president was always saying stuff like that to me. Humph and Occasionally a harumph. Even after working together for 8 years, I hadn't decoded the meanings behind them. Barack was at times a fortress, at other times a glass case of emotion, as Will Ferrell would say.
How do you like the little beast?
I raised an eyebrow.
My new ride,
Barack said, patting his leather armrest. His mood seemed much improved since Wednesday. He explained that the aftermarket upgraded Escalade was as close to his armored presidential limos, the so-called beasts, that Barack could buy on the open market. He'd had this one imported from Afghanistan. It had been his gift to himself, after completing the first draft of his presidential memoirs. When Michelle saw what he'd paid for it, she said, "You better have a couple more book ideas inside that thick skull of yours." "I'm guessing it's not a coincidence that you're in Delaware again," I said. Barack leaned forward between the front seats. "Could we get a little privacy back here, Steve?" The agent turned the radio up. It was a newer rock and roll tune. I missed the stuff you could dance to. Buddy Holly, The Four Seasons. Not that I'd ever been much of a dancer. I'd been known to trip over my own feet, even when I wasn't on a dance floor.
"We saw you at the funeral," Barack said.
"You've been following me. We went to the cemetery to pay our respects. You didn't know Finn. I knew how much he meant to you," Barack said. "We were going to flag you down afterward and say hi, but Steve and I saw you get in that van. It was all white, generic, perfect for an afternoon kidnapping. After finding that map, we didn't want to take any chances."
"You followed me?"
"For your safety. I'm not a child, you know. You could have called me." He sighed. "You're right, Joe. But I still think you should at least look into getting private security, like I suggested. If not for you, then for your family." "Leave my family out of this," I snapped.
"Whoa, easy, fella. It's me, your pal, Barry. I'm not some bad guy."
I unclenched my fists. I hadn't even been aware I'd been clenching them.
"I'm sorry," I said. "I don't even know who the bad guys are anymore." "I'm sure Finn Donnelly wasn't a bad guy."
"You don't know that. I don't know that. Nobody knows that." I told Barack about my meeting with my detective friend, Dan Capriotti. "The department's working this as a possible overdose. The life insurance company is investigating it as a suicide. I don't know who to believe. There are some strange guys around."
"Strange guys?"
"Ran into some druggie at the facility where his wife is living. Probably nothing, but..." I shrugged. "Did you know they found heroin on Finn? Can you believe that?"
"I was going to let you know. We just found out today, when the lieutenant faxed the case files to us."
"You can stop doing that, you know."
"What?"
I rolled my eyes. "What you're doing? I know you think you're helping me, but I've got my own contact on the force. Dan will let me know if they find anything important. Finn may have been mixed up with some dangerous people. For all I know, he was on his way to see me, to ask for my help. Now, do I believe he was on drugs? There's nothing to say he wasn't. I think the truth is going to be more complex, but there's nothing you or your sunglass-wearing goons can do but get in the way. You're free to go back to Bali or Cape Town or wherever and work on your tan." He stared at me with thin lips but didn't say anything. What did he expect? He seemingly wanted to pick up right where we'd left off, like no time had passed since we'd left Washington. To be fair, it was exactly what I'd wanted. Except it wasn't. I'd expected we'd go out for drinks together. Maybe play a few holes, like in the line we'd been feeding to the press. Instead, we'd been reunited by tragedy. The specter of death hovered over us, poisoning the air we breathed. It didn't help that Barack was his usual impenetrable self. What did he get out of spending his energy and resources on something like this? He hadn't known Finn.
He was working an angle. I'd never known him to be underhanded, but his every move was choreographed. There was something about all of this that he wasn't sharing with me. The suspicion had been gnawing at me since Barak's first visit. It was gnawing at me even harder now. I'd already come to the realization that the police might not be putting maximum effort into their investigation. Dan still hadn't returned my call from yesterday. The trouble was, I'd also realized I couldn't uncover the truth about Finn's death on my own. I wasn't a detective. I didn't know what questions to ask or how to ask them. But that didn't mean I needed Barak's help. "There's no reason for you to get your hands dirty," I told Barak. "The last thing we need is the Secret Service or the FBI or the NSA or whoever you want to call in complicating things." "Joe," he said. His voice was flatter than Kansas. "I'm serious. If I know you, there'll be drones buzzing Wilmington within a week. This isn't a war zone. I don't want you to turn it into one. You and I are private citizens now. There's no way this ends well if we start swinging our dicks around, Joe." "Don't Joe me," I said. "I'm serious." "You're serious. As a heart attack sandwich." "Well," Barak said, "that's that, I guess." For the rest of the way to my place, Barak busied himself on his BlackBerry. I stared out the window. There was more to refusing Barak's assistance than my hurt feelings. The story behind Finn's death was a time bomb. If and when it went off, there was no telling how many people would be affected by the blast. Keeping Barak and Jill and the rest of my family as far away from my clumsy attempts to defuse it was the right thing to do. It was the smart thing to do. It was a lie so well told, I almost believed it myself. Chapter 11. I punched the code on my garage keypad and the door lifted, revealing an empty parking space. I'd managed to beat Jill home. My shoulders relaxed. The last thing I wanted to do was answer a bunch of questions about why I was hitching rides from Barack Obama. She'd been on the receiving end of more than one rant about Barack. "Give him time," she'd said, again and again. "He just needs some time to himself." Her explanation always made me laugh. Time to himself? He wasn't spending time alone, or even with his family. He was hanging around with an endless array of celebrities, holding open auditions for a new best friend. And now that he hadn't found one, he'd come crawling back to me. He didn't have the decency to beg for forgiveness, or even say those two magical words, "I'm sorry." And was that too much to ask? I gave the Escalade a little wave once the garage door was up. Barak and Steve had insisted on waiting in the driveway until I made it inside. I'd told them not to worry that I didn't have my keys, but I knew the 6-digit code for the garage. They said, "Oh no, it's no big deal, we'll wait just to make sure." Make sure of what? That I hadn't forgotten how to open my own garage door in my old age? I didn't wait around to watch them leave. Inside, I stripped off my suit. My knee was beginning to swell. There was no telling how much I damaged it. All I knew was that I was lucky I could stand after that fall. Damned lucky. Jill wasn't going to be happy with me. Even if I'd gotten her roses, they wouldn't have made up for the growing list of transgressions I was going to need to apologize for. I limped through the kitchen, in my undershirt and boxers. I was about to open the freezer door, when I noticed the phone on the wall was blinking. I think we were the last people in Delaware with a landline. The world was changing, but I wasn't. I picked up the handset. I figured it was probably Jill, with a reminder about the chicken, or somebody risking an FCC fine to sell us cut-rate car insurance. But the message was from Selena Esposito, Lieutenant Selena Esposito. A sales call would have been vastly preferable. Esposito had the gravelly voice of a pack-a-day smoker. It was the first time I'd heard her voice, but it perfectly matched her reputation for being tough as a $2 steak. Her message said she wanted to talk mano a mano. I didn't like the sound of that. Whatever she wanted, I had to nip it in the bud. I didn't want to see this whole thing spiral out of control. When I called her back, she picked up on the first ring. "Didn't think I'd hear from you so quickly," she said. "I wasn't sure I had the right number." "It's me," I said. "Do you have a few minutes?" "I just returned from Finn Donnelly's funeral. I've got a minute or two." "Good," she said. I heard the sound of paper rustling in the background. "I hear you met with Detective Capriotti yesterday." "We didn't discuss the case, if that's what you're worried about. Just two old friends meeting for coffee." "Don't bullshit a bullshitter, Joe. You don't drink coffee." I didn't say anything. If you don't have anything good to say, keep your mouth shut. That's what Mama Biden always told me. This is my department. I'm in charge here, not your friend Capriotti, or anyone else down here you might know from preschool. We're all on the same team, she snorted. I'm not going to let you or any of your Secret Service lackeys come through here and treat my detectives like errand boys. Now, Dan likes to show off. God knows that's why he wanted this case, but he's got a dozen other dead bodies in the morgue to deal with. The Secret Service aren't my... They're not your what? I'd been about to say that they weren't my lackeys, but thought better of it. She obviously wasn't aware that Steve had been bugging her at Barack's behest, not mine. There was no love lost between Barack and me. That didn't mean I wanted to see him dragged any deeper into this mess. You have to understand, Finn and I were friends, I said, regaining my cool. I filled her in on the basics of our relationship, careful not to offer any unsolicited information. I had something of a reputation for being loose-lipped. You're friends with a lot of people, it sounds like, she said. I ignored her. Listen, a man lost his life here. All I want is to make sure justice is done. His wife is sick. His daughter is having a rough time handling this. Every criminal has somebody who loves them, she said. They're still criminals. Finn wasn't a criminal. Then what would you call someone with a Schedule I drug in their pocket? A hero? Drug abuse is a disease. We need to stop treating addicts like violent offenders. He's not a hero, but it's disingenuous to call him a criminal. The law says differently, Joe. She was right, of course. The law was the law. Barack and I hadn't done enough to change it. The changes we'd made were being rolled back by the new administration. It was almost like we'd never been in office. Fine, I said. Fine? You're right. I'm letting my personal feelings get the better of me. So you're going to leave my boy alone? If you insist on wasting any more of his time, you're going to regret it. But he was the one that approached me, I wanted to say. Except there was no point. She could make Dan's life hell if she wanted to. I told her I'd have the service go through the proper channels for any future requests. She didn't need to know that the service's involvement here had been off the record. She didn't need to know I'd told Barack to drop it. How's that sound to you? You know what, Joe? What's that? You're a lot smarter than I thought you'd be. Was that a compliment? She hung up without answering. I stared out the picture window that looked out onto the backyard and beyond that, the lake. The surface of the water was as calm as a soul at rest. Part of me wondered if it wouldn't be in everyone's interest to just let Finn be. The doorbell rang. Without thinking, I undid the deadbolt and swung open the door. It was Steve. "Forget something?" I asked. I was vaguely aware that I was in my skivvies, but didn't care. There were more important things on my mind. "Your flowers, sir." He held out the bouquet of lilies. "Keep them," I said, slamming the door in his face. The shocked look on his face as the door swung closed was priceless. My satisfaction, however, was short-lived. He rang the doorbell again, and Champ barked. I didn't want to answer it because I was still pretty wound up, not just about the stupid flowers, about everything. If Esposito had really put the clamp down on Dan, that meant I was frozen out of my back door into the department. I wasn't going to be able to convince her there was an ongoing Secret Service investigation for very long. The larger question was, why did I think I could piece together the puzzle of Finn's final hours any better than the police could? It was becoming obvious that Finn had gotten sucked under by the currents of something dark and powerful. Now I was swimming in those same murky waters. If I wasn't careful, the undertow would pull me down as well. I could sense my frustration getting the better of me. If I opened the door again, I was either going to stammer out an apology to Steve or slam it right back in his flat face. I just wanted to go upstairs, draw a bath, and soak my banged-up knee. The doorbell rang again. Champ barked. I took a deep breath. "Stay back," I told Champ, putting a leg between him and the door. I opened the door a crack. It wasn't Steve this time. It was Barack. We stood there in the doorway, Barack and me, staring into each other's eyes like a couple of gunslingers ready to face off at high noon. Except it was past 5 o'clock, I was in my boxers and neither of us had a six-shooter. "Aren't you going to invite me in?" Chapter 12 Slamming the door in Barack Obama's face wasn't an option. Or it was, but it wasn't one that I felt like exercising. It was the nuclear option. I stepped aside. "Come on in, Mr. President." He wiped his shoes off on the mat. Steve quickly followed with the bouquet. Cham trotted behind them, sniffing at their pant legs. Barack measured up the inside of her home with narrowed eyes.
Nice place you've got here, Joe.
We were in the entryway. Holly could see of the interior were the twin spiraling staircases. It was a hollow compliment if I'd ever heard one.
I'm going to put some clothes on. You two can head on to the living room, I said, pointing down the hall, and make yourselves comfortable.
I threw on a navy bathrobe. I didn't have time to go through my closet looking for a clean pair of Dockers. There was still a chance I could get Barack and Steve out of the house before Jill came home. When I returned downstairs, I found them sitting on the leather sofa in the living room. Barack was scratching behind Champ's ears. The dog had a blissed-out look.
"Very Hugh Hefner," Barack said when he spied my robe. "I like it."
I took a seat in the recliner. "I don't want to be a party pooper, but Jill's going to be home soon. If she sees you here, I'll catch hell for inviting guests over for dinner without telling her first. She's got dinner all planned out, and we won't be staying long," Barack said. He didn't look me in the eye. "There's just something I wanted to say, that I didn't get to say to you in the car." I crossed my arms. "If you're here to say you're sorry, that ship has sailed."
"Sorry? For what?"
"Sorry for, I stammered. I knew exactly what I wanted to say, but the words were stuck in the back of my tongue. "Sorry for it." Barack and Steve exchanged glances, and Barack threw his hands up.
"What I wanted to say was that there's more."
"More what?"
"I'm not trying to scare you. I know you want to let the police handle this whole situation. I know you have the utmost respect for the boys in blue. Just spit it out, man."
Barack turned to the agent sitting by his side.
"The folder, Steve."
Steve was holding a manila folder behind the flowers and started to hand it to Barack. I reached out across the coffee table and swiped it from them. Inside, there was a sheaf of 8x10 photographs. They were all shots of a house that looked like it had been ripped apart by a pit bull puppy on adrenaline shots. I looked up at Barack.
"I don't understand."
"That's Finn Donnelly's house," he said. "Of course, he hasn't lived there for a while."
"Where was he living?"
"An hotel motel close to the railroad tracks," Barack said. "Finn never said anything about it. I thought he was part of your so-called second family."
"I say that about everyone at Amtrak," I said. "With Finn, it was a bit truer than with most. Finn started working at Amtrak the same year I started writing, 1972. I went to his wedding. I sent flowers to the hospital when his daughter was born. He didn't always work the train I rode, but I saw him more often than not for over 3 decades. I rode that line, the Metro Liner, 10,000 times.
You count it?"
"Some journalists did. I just inflate the number by 1,000 every time I tell the story."
"It's not a lie if you believe it," Barack said.
"Who said that? Some Marxist philosopher?"
"My father."
"Huh."
I wasn't going to touch that one. I continued. "Anyway, I didn't know he'd moved out of his house. I didn't even know until this week that his wife was in the hospital. His daughter said he was keeping things private. I wished he'd reached out."
"That may have been why he had your address," Barack said. "He needed someone to talk to, or help him out with the bills. Some people are too proud for their own good. They should know it's not a sin to ask for help."
Barack's phone buzzed in his pocket. He ignored it and continued. "As I said, Finn wasn't living in their family home. The house felt too big without his wife."
"That sounds about right," Barack said. "So a few months back, Finn starts renting out their house to a young woman and her son."
"And the new tenants, they did this?" I asked, raising the pictures. Barack shook his head.
"The kid's a toddler, but it takes more than a toddler to do this. These people have been model tenants, paying their rent on time, keeping the yard under control. Last night they went to Finn Donnelly's wake. When they came back, this was how they found the place. Somebody had forced open the back door with a crowbar, according to the officer who wrote the report."
"Anything missing?"
"Tough to say. Doesn't seem to be, though. If I had to hazard a guess, whoever broke in didn't have any clue that the house was being rented."
"Does his family know?"
"Finn's sister knows. So does the daughter. They're both staying in town for the time being.
A Holiday Inn Express.
Nice hotels, continental breakfast.
So I've heard," Barack said.
"What's Lieutenant Esposito think?"
"She doesn't think it's connected to his death. There have been a number of break-ins during funerals and wakes recently."
"Criminals are scouring the obits for victims and striking when no one's home."
I read something about those guys. As far as the Wilmington PD is concerned, this was just a run-of-the-mill burglary. But that's not what you believe. Nothing was stolen, Barak explained. It's possible they were scared off in the middle of the job. That's what the PD is saying. But it's also possible they were searching for something they didn't find. Very possible, I thought. I remembered the man in the nursing home, the one with the long hair, claiming to be ministering to the patients. He'd been snooping around for something, too. I tossed the folder onto the coffee table. Why didn't you want to share these photos with me? I worried I was being paranoid. While we were talking in the car, I realized that I shouldn't have had Steve follow you. It was out of line. It was wrong of me, and I'm sorry. So he knows the words. But after we dropped you off, I thought about it some more. I couldn't shake the feeling that if I kept this from you and something happened, I wouldn't be able to live with myself. The last thing I wanted to do was scare you without reason. Having said that, I don't buy the idea that the burglary and your friend's death are unconnected. I didn't buy it either. I decided there was no harm in bringing Barak up to speed. Detective Capriati was pushing the overdose angle hard yesterday. I would never say a bad word about our local boys in blue, especially Dan, who I've known forever in a lifetime, but something's been eating at me, and I haven't been able to put my finger on it. Until 20 minutes ago, that is. What happened 20 minutes ago? I talked to Lieutenant Esposito. The reason she's taken over the case personally isn't because she's some sort of micromanager. It's because she's worried we'll lead her detectives around town on a wild goose chase. She wants this case shut down. I'm sure her reasoning's on the up and up, too. The last thing the Wilmington Police Department needs is another case for their homicide backlog. A few years ago, they made national headlines by clearing just 15% of all murders. That's below the Mendoza line. Mendoza? It's a baseball thing, I said. The department has improved, but not by much. They're not our only hope here, though. There's also the National Transportation Safety Board, who aren't even going to look at the burglary report, Barak interjected. They're going to look at the engineer of the train and the circumstances surrounding the accident, but that's it. We may be on our own here. We? I almost said, but held my tongue. There was no we, as far as I was concerned. On the other hand, I couldn't dismiss Barak's help. I didn't know why he was so interested in Finn Donnelly, or why he'd chosen now to take an interest in my life again, but Esposito had thrown a wrench into the gears, herself. Unless I was going to ask Dan to risk his job for me, I needed Barak, or at least the Secret Service. As long as Steve was willing to play along, I was too. Has anyone checked out this motel room? I asked, the one where Finn was living. There's nothing in the reports Esposito sent over, Barak said. I would assume his family cleaned it out, but that's just an assumption. How many times have you checked out of a hotel and forgotten something in your room? I'm thinking under the bed or in a dresser drawer. You think you've got everything packed in your suitcase, but maybe you left your phone charger behind the nightstand. He didn't have a cell phone. Last guy in America without one. I threw up my hands. I know that. I'm just saying it might be worth checking out. We need some real evidence, something to prove there's more going on here than it seems. Barak didn't say anything. It's just an idea, I said. If you have a better one. Barak shrugged, then turned to his agent. Find a vase for those flowers, and then we'll head back into town. We're looking for a joint called the Heart of Wilmington Motel. Wait. You want to go there right now? I asked. It was a question, but only sort of. I had the sinking feeling I already knew the answer. Is that going to be a problem? Barak asked. I know Jill. She'll understand. Just call her and let me get dressed, I said. Then to Steve, I added, there's a vase in the pantry, just off the side of the kitchen. I'm sure your GPS can show you the way. I dragged myself upstairs and did a mental tally of the work I needed to finish over the weekend. There were a couple of emails sitting in my inbox that I'd been avoiding all week. One had to do with my new gig at the University of Pennsylvania. Another was about the Biden Institute, the research and public policy institute I'd set up at my alma mater, the University of Delaware. All of it was going to have to wait. My SIG called to me from the closet. We were heading into a dicey part of town, possibly past sundown. I hadn't felt unsafe beneath the interstate, but that was then. This was now. The Secret Service agent would be armed. Why shouldn't I be, too? I spun the dial on the safe, removed the SIG, and felt the gun's weight in my hand. Then I returned it. I realized I didn't need a gun. I wanted a gun. Instead, I pulled out my Presidential Medal of Freedom. It wasn't something you could wear every day, like a class ring. Truth be told, most people just ended up having their medals framed. I hadn't because I knew it would be too painful to look at every day. It was a reminder of 8 great years, 8 wonderful, glorious years that seemed like a lifetime ago. I placed it on my desk. I called Jill while I was getting dressed. It went straight to voicemail. In the kitchen, I scribbled out a note letting her know that I was out with Barack and that I'd fill her in on the details later. I glanced up at the clock on the microwave. It was 5:45 already. The earliest we could make it downtown and back during rush hour would be 8 or 8:30. It was conceivable I wouldn't be home until 9, past our bedtime. I signed my name. Then underneath, as if it was an afterthought, I added, "Don't wait up for me." Chapter 13. Barack Obama and I were 2 fairly high-profile individuals, so it made sense that we should take some measures to conceal our identities. We couldn't risk causing a scene parading around town. There was already enough hoopla surrounding Finn's case. Despite this perfect logic on my part, Barack had a fit when he saw me emerge from the house. "What is that thing on your head?" I touched the brim of my baseball cap. "Kissed my bass," it blared with all the subtlety of a trumpet in your ear. There was an embroidered bass on it, with its mouth open, ready to be reeled in. "It's called the disguise," I said. "Here, I got you one, too." I handed him a maroon cap, embroidered with a large letter P. "Phillies, you know, since you're a White Sox fan, no one will ever suspect it's you." Barack said, staring at the cap. I put on my aviator shades, then smiled. "What do you think?" "Remember when you flew into Minnesota to interview for the VP slot?" he said. "We were so worried people would learn about the interview, and you showed up wearing a plain denim baseball cap and those same sunglasses you're wearing now." It was a different pair. "Point is, nobody recognized you," he said, "but it wasn't because of your so-called disguise. It was because you were a senator from Delaware. Most people outside the Mid-Atlantic region don't even know where the Delaware state lines are. Most Delawareans don't know either. I guess what I'm trying to say is, whether we wear hats or welder's masks is going to be pretty difficult to avoid drawing attention. Plus, everybody's seen you in those glasses." "You're saying I need to take them off to disguise myself?" I said, whipping my Ray-Bans off. "How's that?" Barack stared at me. "You look like Joe Biden either way." "Forget it, then." "No, no. Wear them if it makes you feel comfortable. And you'll wear the Phillies hat." "We'll see," he said. "You're ready to go, then?" I dangled the extra key for my challenger. She was sitting in the garage, begging to be let out of her cage. "Wanna take my car? What's wrong with the little beast?" "We might not be able to avoid attention completely, but we can be smart about it. Think what will happen if we roll up anywhere in that thing, pull into that motel parking lot, and people are going to stare." "Says the guy who's dressed for a safari." I glanced down at my sandals, blue chino shorts, and orange and yellow Aloha shirt. Barack had gifted me the shirt 1 year for my birthday. I'd called it a Hawaiian shirt, and he told me not to call it that. He explained that in Hawaii, they were called Aloha shirts. "I can go back inside and change." Barack held up a hand. "We just waited 20 minutes for you to change, Joe." He nodded at the Escalade. "As for the little beast, you have to weigh the benefits here. The body's been reinforced with military-grade armor. Its windows can withstand armor-piercing bullets. The shocks are so good you can drive over a landmine and not spill your tea. Plus, there's a button you push, and it turns the exhaust into a flamethrower." "Really?" "No, but that's damn near the only thing it doesn't have." I hit the button on my keychain and waited for the garage door to dramatically unveil my baby, my neon-green 2017 Dodge Challenger TA, a throwback to the 1970s Trans Am series muscle cars. "You weren't the only one who bought a new car." Barack's eyes opened wide. "What did you do with your Stingray?" "It's at the beach house." Barack pinched the spot between his eyes. He was trying to be nonchalant about my new muscle car, but I could tell he was itching to get in and go for a test drive. Steve would never go for it. Steve was leaning against the SUV in the driveway, staring intently at his wristwatch. He had two fingers to the left of his Adam's apple, feeling his pulse.
There's plenty of room in back for Steve.
I slipped into the driver's seat and started her up. She purred to life. A real beauty, no denying it. Over the sound of the engine, I shouted, 3.6-liter Pentastar VVT V6 engine with an 8-speed torque flight automatic transmission that really gets up and goes. I gave her a little gas and Barack jumped. Turn it off, he said. When you get her on the open road, she flies like Christ on a bike. No way, Barack said. There's no way. I nodded toward the little beast. What's the gas mileage on that thing? The Challenger was an old-school gas guzzler, a muscle car in a world of flab. Still, it had to get better mileage than Barack's armored SUV, which looked as if it drank gas like the tweeter-in-chief drank Diet Coke. Barack sighed. I had backed him into a corner and used his own ethics against him. A cruel trick. A career politician's trick. He said, Where do you want us to park the little beast? If we parked it in the garage, there wouldn't be any room for Jill to pull in. Barack's SUV was so wide, it would take up both spaces. If we parked the SUV in the driveway, neighbors might start whispering. It looked just enough like the old beasts that someone might put two and two together. The last thing I wanted was a couple of Johnny Crabapples trying to do the math. There's a Walmart not far from here, I said. Plenty of people park their Winnebagos there. It'll be fine. Why not here? It just wouldn't be a good idea. Barack stared at me. Did you tell Jill you were going out with me? It's none of her business who I go out with. I'm in the seventh decade of my life. I can do whatever I want. No one's the boss of me. I used to be your boss. The American people were our boss, I told him. But things have changed. He shook his head and wiped a bead of sweat from his brow. Did you bring that heater you were packing the other night? I felt a twinge of embarrassment. Of course, Barack knew I was a gun owner. I'd talked about my shotguns enough that he could probably tell you the make and model, but he wasn't talking about my shotguns. There have been reports of prowlers, I said. You can't be too careful. You're right about that. A lot going on in this world. Even when it comes to friendly faces, it's hard to tell who to trust these days. He paused. So you're bringing it? I'm not bringing it. He looked me steady in the eye, as if he was trying to assess whether I was lying or not. Finally satisfied, he fit the Phillies cap on his head. Then let's go, Joe.
Chapter 14. I swung the Challenger into the motel parking lot. There were around 20 rooms lined up in a row, with the main office situated in the middle. A half-dozen cars, all nondescript jalopies. The very idea that Finn had lived the last few months of his life in this roach haven made me sick to my stomach. He'd been a proud government employee. He deserved better.
Color TVs, Barack said, reading from the sign out front.
Color TVs? That settles it, I said. I'm getting us a room. Steve piped up from the back seat. If we're staying here, I'd like to check the rooms first for potential jackals. Run the place in the parking lot.
We're not staying here, Barack said. Job was kidding.
I'd stayed in dumps like the heart of Wilmington on my first campaign for city council. There was no way Barack and I would be staying here, not now that we'd reached an age where a good night's sleep was more refreshing than a lemonade. Which room was Finn's? I asked.
110, Barack said.
I looked at Steve. You're the one with the badge. Why don't you see if it's available for a quick look-see?
And leave you two here on your own? You think we're going to drive off without you? Barack asked.
I'm concerned about your safety, Mr. President.
We'll wait in the car, Barack said. We'll lock the doors. If anybody so much as looks in our direction, we'll honk the horn. Then you can come in guns a-blazing and save the day. You'll look like a hero. They'll give you a book deal.
What would I do with a book deal? I took my glasses off and rubbed the bridge of my nose. The sun was beginning to set. The drive had taken twice as long as I'd expected, thanks to Steve's insistence that we stick to back roads. Apparently everything with Steve was going to take twice as long.
I'll go, I said, unlocking my door.
Steve sighed rather dramatically.
Stay in the car. I'll be right back.
He left us, muttering something under his breath that sounded a lot like,
6 weeks, 6 weeks, 6 weeks.
I leaned close to Barack.
What happens in 6 weeks? He's leaving for CAT training, Barack said.
The guy's been putting his body through hell the past 6 months, trying to get in shape. You can ask him all about it. He'll talk your ear off if you give him a chance.
Huh.
You know, it's his job to protect us, Barak said. It's his job to protect you. That shut Barak up. If Steve graduated from the training program, he would join the counter-assault team, an elite paramilitary squad of service agents who provided the firepower in case of an attack on the president. Steve was on his way to the show. No more time putzing around with has-beens like us. Once Steve was inside the motel office, I swung open my door.
Where are you going? Barak asked.
Cool your jets. I'm just stretching my legs. I slammed the door and hobbled around the car, trying to work out the kinks in my back. The kinks in my leg were going to need more work. The swelling around my knee looked worse than before. I'd obviously torn something, and I wasn't sure it would heal on its own. It hurt when I stretched my leg, and it hurt when I didn't stretch my leg. It needed ice and rest, neither of which I was likely to get any time soon. I returned to my seat and turned up the radio. All I heard was the faint voice of a preacher, fading in and out, sermonizing about heaven and hell. I had heard enough sermonizing at the service today. I turned off the radio.
That's interesting, Barak said.
At first I thought he meant the radio program, but then I followed Barak's gaze to a woman standing at the door of a room. She was fumbling through her purse. The room number read 110, Finn's room. I didn't have a good view of her face, but I could see she had long blonde hair pulled back into a ponytail that reached her waist.
How do you think she uses the toilet? I asked Barak.
Excuse me? With hair that long, she can't just sit down or she'd dip it into the toilet. If she flips it to the side, it touches the floor. Forget her hair. She's trying to jimmy open the door.
I took a second look.
My vision wasn't what it once was, but it appeared she was sliding a credit card alongside the door lock. The motel's doors had old-style keyholes, not magnetic card readers.
She could be a guest, I said without conviction.
Could be, Barak said. Then again, she could be the burglar who broke into the Donnelly's home during the wake.
Could be.
There's only one way to find out. I opened my door.
We should wait for Steve, Barak said.
But it was too late. I was already out of the car. I wasn't waiting around for him. The Secret Service couldn't tell me what to do anymore. Barak mumbled something and got out too. I took one look at his gray-flecked scalp and shook my head.
What?
He whispered. Your cap, I said. I reached back into the car and handed Barak the Phillies hat.
Oh, and don't lose it. It's Jill's. She's a Phillies fan. Don't ask me why.
Barak put it on, but when we turned back around, it was too late. The woman was gone. Was she in the room, or had we spooked her? Again, there was only one way to find out. We approached the door to room 110, moving as stealthily as my bum knee would allow. Inside, the lights were out. The curtains were pulled shut. I put a hand on the knob and gave it a slight twist. It wasn't locked. Neither of us had a weapon. This was a minor problem. If somebody, the woman, had just broken into the room, this meant she was a criminal. And criminals carry guns. I wished I'd packed my pistol. But then again, maybe it was a good thing I hadn't. If we really, truly ran into trouble, would I have been able to pull it out of my chino shorts without shooting off my family jewels? Barak would have a real field day if that ever happened. Barak placed one of his oversized ears on the door. Political cartoonists had loved to mock Barak's elephant ears, if only they could see him now, using them for their God-intended purpose.
What do you hear? I whispered.
A pickup the size of a semi rolled past the motel.
I don't hear a thing, Barak said after it had passed.
Then I say we go in.
Legally speaking, we're treading on some dangerous ground, Barak said.
This is breaking and entering.
Even if the door's unlocked?
Barak nodded.
Damn it, I said. I don't want to start another Watergate.
We're not in the White House anymore. We're private citizens, and as private citizens, it's still illegal.
Even if the door's unlocked?
I already said. The door swung inward. I tumbled to the floor and Barak tripped over me. We landed in a heap, a jumbled mess of arms and legs.
Can I help you?
I looked up. The lamps were off, but there was a thin beam of light coming from the bathroom, illuminating the room. just enough to see the curvaceous outline of a beautiful woman with damp hair down to her waist. She was wearing a white hotel towel. Just a white towel. Whatever Barack and I thought we'd seen her doing outside, we'd obviously been wrong. I didn't imagine many burglars stopped to take showers during heists. I tipped my hat to her. "Good evening, ma'am. We were looking for the pool," Barack said, untwisting himself from me. "We appear to have taken a wrong turn." The woman studied us for a moment. I might have been dressed for the pool, but there was no way Barack was going swimming in his navy suit.
"They didn't tell me there was a pool," the woman said with a hint of a southern accent.
"Come on, Joe. We'll take it up with the front desk," Barack said. Then to the woman he added, "Sorry to have disturbed you." She maintained the bewildered look on her face as we quietly backed out of the room. "I can't believe you called me by my real name," I said in a hushed tone on our way back to the car. "I don't think she recognized us," Barack said. "I mean, we have these great disguises." "You're making fun of me," Barack slapped me on the back. "She can call all of her friends. She can post about it online. Who would ever believe her?" I shrugged. "Yeah, you're right. Still, next time we run into trouble, we're using code names." "Next time?" Barack asked. "What are you planning?" I had only a vague idea of what we'd been coming here to do, and that vague idea was mostly hot air. We'd just busted in on some innocent woman because our imaginations had gotten the better of us. Neither of us said a word about it, though. We were too embarrassed. What was I planning next? Nothing, if I could help it. We returned to the car. Steve stepped out of the lobby with a key in his hand, attached to a small wooden keychain. I rolled down Barack's window. "Let's make this quick," Steve said, passing the key to room 110 to Barack. "The night clerk said we can take a look around." "What about the person in the room now?" Barack asked. Steve looked confused. "No one's staying in the room now. It's supposed to be empty." "Son of a buttermilk biscuit," I said, grimacing. "We got bamboozled." Chapter 15. It wasn't the first time I had been bamboozled. It wouldn't be the last. Still, I should have seen it coming. There wasn't a woman alive who'd take a shower in a motel room without locking the door first. She'd taken us for fools because we were a couple of fools, especially when it came to the fairer sex. Barack and I were chivalrous to a fault. We should have trusted our instincts. Instead, we'd been flustered into doubting ourselves. The woman was long gone by the time we returned to the room. She'd left the door swinging open and the towel hanging over the back of the chair. The towel wasn't even wet. "If you'll let me know what we're looking for, I can help," Steve offered. He turned on a lamp. It flickered for a moment before shorting out. "This is the first time I've tossed a room for evidence," I said, lifting one of the pillows off the bed as if I was looking for change left by the tooth fairy. "Fingerprints, I guess?" "The fingerprints would have been wiped clean by the cleaning person," Barack said, holding one of the glasses up to the overhead light. "Although it looks like no one's cleaned anything in this room in 20 years. It would take us weeks to dust for prints." "I left my fingerprint dusting kit at home, so I guess it doesn't matter," I said. "You have a fingerprint dusting kit?" Barack asked. I peeked underneath the bed. The FBI gave them to everyone in Congress one year, a Christmas gift. It took longer than usual to get to my feet on account of my knee. Looks like they have a little mouse problem at this establishment. "Find some mouse droppings?" Barack asked. "Found a mouse," I said. "Just a little guy." "You don't seem too surprised. For $29 a night, I'm surprised he wasn't bigger." I opened and closed the drawers in the dresser, all of which, of course, were empty. They'd been cleaned out by Finn's family, then by housekeeping, and then, possibly, by the woman who'd given us the slip. Besides the bed and a ratty green sofa chair, the room was as bare as a newborn baby's bottom. There wasn't a safe in the closet. There wasn't even a closet. There was a nightstand, but no pad of paper or pen. That meant I couldn't try out that trick from TV, where the detective rubs a pencil over the top page to get an impression of whatever the criminal had written on the ripped-off page. I opened the nightstand drawer. Finally, something. A Gideon Bible. The familiar mottled maroon imitation leather hardback of the Bible that was in every hotel room in the country. The same type of Bible the tattooed man had left behind in Darlene's room. Not that this was any kind of connection. In fact, if the Bible had been missing from the drawer, that would have been something.
This? This was nothing. Either of you ever met a Gideon?
Barak shook his head. Steve, peeking through the curtain, said,